Okay, tonight we're talking lots of things, or if not all things B. Professor Steve Morris, who you heard at the start, has been involved in research on many topics in New Zealand during his time at Massey University. I had a quick look online and I see papers published on lots of sheep management topics, forage management, and even a few papers in there around farmer learning and extension and some of those sorts of things. However, I think he's probably best known, or he's certainly very well known for his work on beef animals, large and small, the length and breadth of the country. And Beef and Lamb New Zealand currently, it's been a long gestation period, but currently putting the final touches to our new guide to New Zealand sheep, to New Zealand cattle farming, excuse me, and Steve is the key author of that book. For those of you, you might remember our old beef cow book and our old profitable beef production book. It's replacing both of those, and it's imminent. It's not quite going to make it for Christmas, but it'll certainly be here early in the new year. So we thought it's the ideal time to have Steve on the call with that book following up very shortly. So welcome to the call, Steve. You may need little or no introduction after all of that, but how about you give us one anyway? What's your current role at Massey and maybe the potted history of your career, how you ended up where you are now?
Yeah, sure. I'm Professor of Animal Science here with responsibilities in sheep and beef. We have about 15 researchers, teachers, extension people here working in mainly sheep, but increasingly crossing over into beef. And that's sort of my role, is to direct them, and I try and direct a few over into beef cattle. My colleague who does quite a lot of work, Dr. Rebecca Hickson, sort of leads the beef research here. I actually started my work in early research work in beef and then moved over to sheep for my PhD, and I sort of moved between the two as funding allowed. As everyone out there who farms beef cattle knows, with the long time from conception to slaughter, it's very difficult to get long-term funding for beef cattle work, so sheep funding is easier and quicker to get hold of, so I've fluctuated between the two, but we certainly keep our eye on beef cattle research and try and do some, and we've been very fortunate with Beef and Lamb New Zealand to fund some, certainly since about the year 2000, right through to now. We've had good pockets of money from Beef and Lamb New Zealand, which has helped keep beef research going at Massey. I grew up on a hill country farm about 30 miles, 50 kilometres inland from Whanganui in a place called Mangamahu. So I grew up with beef cattle and around me, and you know, it's my first love, and sheep is second, really. But if I'm trying to get money, I'll say it either way.
Yeah, very well put. Hey, it's interesting, actually, you know, just sitting working for Beef and Lamb New Zealand, to notice the changing trends, and obviously there's been a bit of a resurgence in beef lately, and obviously the supply of calves out of the dairy industry had a big impact, which is a couple of things we're going to talk about tonight. So certainly a lot more interest in beef out there, and I think one of the things we wonder whether, you know, talked for years about a slightly ageing farming population, and whether there is more interest in cattle with people feel that they've got a lower workload with a higher cattle ratio. But look, we're going to get into the call, and it'll be mainly question and answer. It works best that way, back and forth, and questions come in and we can expand on a few things. But what we also like to give our speakers at the start is what we call, you know, the elevator pitch. That's the idea where you describe a concept or a project or a couple of key things in the length of time you'd have somebody, a captive audience, in an elevator. So I think I've explained that's what we're after, Steve. What's your elevator pitch? If you had a beef farmer stuck in the elevator between a few floors, what would be the, you know, the one, the two, the three things that you'd really want to stress that they pay attention to or get right in their systems?
The first one is, right now, they should have the figure one in their head. That means that calf growth, so that if they're a beef cow herd, the calves should be growing at 1 kilogram a day right now. And put simply, let's say we have a 35 kilogram at birth. We wean at 200 days, you're heading for 235 kilograms at weaning. That's the simple message right now. And if we're not doing that, then we're not maximizing our returns from our beef cow herd. The other one I would say is to do that, and to ensure the cow gets back in calf, cow condition score is important. And right now, as you approach mating, some of you may have started, some of you will be coming on in mid-December, some later in December, the beef cow should be hitting up over 6 in condition score at mating to ensure that we get a good conception rate. And those of you who heard me talk about it before, we want a concentrated calving. We want more than, I say, upwards of 60% conceiving in the first 21 days that the bull is out. And then everything mated no longer than 60 days. So that would be my two pitches to everyone. If everyone's achieving that, then the national calving percentage will move from 82% towards that 90.
All right. Yeah, I think you might have only got between about 3 floors, but that's a good point because they tie in with a couple of questions we've got, and we'll build on a wee bit later. But actually, I'm going to pick on that last point you made. The national average calving percentage is about 82%. If you look at stats, say Beef and Lamb New Zealand economic survey stats, that hasn't moved a lot, or it doesn't seem to have moved a lot in the last decade. Is that the case? Is calving percentage not moving? And if not, why not?
No, it hasn't moved much, and you're right. It has been pretty static around that figure. I guess there's different reasons, and it's how farmers measure it. You know, a lot of farmers measure calving percentage of cows wintered, calves mated versus, calves weaned, cows wintered, and I think the national average is actually calves weaned, cows mated. So there's a bit of a difference there. You know, a lot of farmers talk, and the difference is that people are happy to cull on pregnancy going into the winter, and so they don't worry about those cows, and that probably keeps the percentage down in the low, in the mid to low 80s. So that's the first thing, is how people measure it. But I always say, you know, if you've got 100 cows that you put to the bull, 95% should get pregnant. So there's your 5% wastage. Then of that, 95% should rear a calf to the next weaning, and that's your 90% calving. That should be the target. You know, you multiply 95, 95 together, and you get 90.
Okay. So 90% is a target, 82, 84% national average. What's the, why are we losing those extra 8 calves, or why are we not getting those extra 8 calves per 100 cows?
Well, there'll be several reasons. On different farms, where farmers farm them, I guess in the harder country, feed shortage will mean that the cows are in poorer condition going to the bull. Maybe less cycling, or they're only cycling at their first cycle after calving, and so we're not getting that 60% in the first 21 days, and so cows are only having 2 shots at the bull if you've got a 60-day mating cycle. Those are the cows that are in better condition and maybe going to the bull at their second cycle after calving, and so you're getting that higher percentage in calf. That'll be the first thing, less getting in calf. The second one will be maybe losses occurring during pregnancy, although I don't think that's as big as a lot of people say. The other one will be losses around calving, and again, that'll depend on where farmers are farming cows. Actually, to be honest, Aaron, there's been very, very few detailed on-farm in recent times. We can go back a bit to quite a lot of data in the 70s, but not recently of losses from mating all the way through to the next weaning. Very few on-farm studies.
So one of the things you touched on there a couple of times is talking about condition. And you started right at the start, what a target, 6+, I think, at mating was what you said, and then you just need to answer there. You mentioned a couple of times about cows not at ideal condition or for whatever reason that may be. How important is body condition scoring in your eyes for a beef cow farmer, and what are sort of the key times of the year you'd like to see people condition scoring their cow herd and taking remedial action if needed?
The cow, this is on a scale of 1 to 10. Generally, cows are at their fattest and heaviest at weaning. all other things being equal, obviously if they've come through a summer drought, that won't be the case. But the body condition score at weaning is often the best, and it'll be around 7. It's probably prudent to take some of that condition off going into midwinter, and maybe even right back down to condition score 5. And then keeping it at that through to calving. So there's the third point, weaning, midwinter, calving, the three times that you'd score. And then, so they would calve in a condition score of 5 and then head back up to 6 plus at mating, which is the fourth time that I say is the optimum times to condition score. So there's the four times that I would think that managers of cattle herds would get the most out of condition scoring.
Sorry, Aaron, we've got
a mixture of breeds out there, haven't we, and crossbreeds. Mm-hmm. And the thing about condition scoring is that it gets around the weight thing. You know, different sized cows, you know, some people have 550-kilo cows, some have 500-kilo cows, some have 600. But the condition score goes across all of those weight ranges. And it also gets around the conceptus, you know. So as you approach calving, if you've got a 40-kilo calf inside the cow, then it's going to have another 25 kilos of membranes and things. So you've got 65 kilos. So it's quite hard to interpret cow live weights at that time. So condition score is quite a good way to get a assessment of how your feeding's going.
Hmm. So you're talking there about, you know, averages across the herd. Is what would be your... how low, you know, when would you, what cows would you take out and give remedial action, extra feeding, that sort of thing? Are you talking below 3, below 2, what's, or anything?
No,
below
I'm talking
4 or 5?
Probably 4 and below. Mm-hmm. Probably need some, need some action.
Yep.
When I say weaning, well, they'll be at their best. If you've had a hard summer and they're not mm-hmm. at their best, then you obviously wouldn't be wanting to take too much condition off them. And so at each of those points that I said, weaning, midwinter, calving, mating, you might be drafting off the lighter ones to try and bring them back up to what your targets are.
And what about at the other end? Do you get worried about a cow being too fat?
Yeah, you do. It's a waste of feed. It's the main thing. The main thing is a waste of feed, but there is a bit of data to show that the fat ones sometimes don't breed as well, but it's the main thing I'd be worried about is a waste of feed.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. I'm just building on that. Well, this is actually a question that came in that sort of relates to this stuff, but is there still a place for beef cows in New Zealand? We've got a big black and white herd churning out a whole lot of calves that we can tap into as needed. We're doing work getting better beef genetics into that dairy herd. You know, we've seen the numbers of the beef cows decline. Is there a place for the beef cow still in New Zealand, or can we make do without them?
It's a loaded question, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's probably one that was asked to Bob Barton back in the 60s, probably asked to several people over the last 50 years. And it's still relevant then as it is today. The answer is maybe we could do without a beef cow herd and we could get everything from the bobby calf industry, certainly from the dairy industry. Certainly if we stopped having a bobby calf industry, then we'd have to think about that, wouldn't we? But my feeling right now is that we've got the beef cow herd on a national basis just under that 1 million, sort of fluctuating between 950,000 and 1 million. It hasn't moved down or up too much in the last 5 or 6 years, even though we've had some terrible summer droughts and whatnot. I think we're getting on. Beef cows are probably in the wetter type hill country right now. They're probably the drier regions of New Zealand, say in the Wairarapa Hill Country, they've got out of beef cows. Probably the drier regions have got out of it. The cow is probably in country where, unless you've got a lot of fencing and you've got another class of animal that can eat rank feed, or you're spot on with your sheep management and in terms of pasture control, then the beef cow is the best animal at turning that sort of rough feed in late December, you know, as the brown top grows in some of those hill country properties or the native pasture species up there through late December, January, February, that beef cow can turn that stuff, which is probably reaching an ME, an energy value of sort of 9.5, 10, the beef cow can still turn that into a highly digestible nutrient for the calf, so it can grow at a kilogram a day. And if you put any other, you know, if you've got that feed and can't control it any other way, there's really no other animal that will do that.
So the next question that's come in actually ties in really nicely with that. If there's that place, how do we value that? Because when you see gross margins on a per kilogram of dry matter basis, and beef cows usually struggle to be match anything else, but that's assuming every kilogram of dry matter is equal to each other. Whereas you just touched on, you know, the beef cows can use stuff that nothing else can and still grow calves on it. And the other aspect that's often raised is what they add by doing that to, you know, other stock enterprises. What have you looked at that? You know, how do we, can we account for what beef cows actually add to the rest of the system, or what they truly are earning on that feed that nothing else will be able to use?
Yeah, it's a difficult one and has to be done on individual farms, but certainly that feed that I'm talking about, then the beef cow should be given a negative if you're doing a gross margin across versus sheep versus something or other, or a sense of return per kilogram of dry matter. They should be given a negative value in the summer because they're doing a positive job for you. But in terms of what that figure should be, there's one or two people had a go at trying to value it, you know, and you might say if they're eating a lot of grass in the winter, then the value of that grass in the winter is actually quite higher than the negative value. In the, you know, it might be worth 20 cents a kilogram dry matter in the winter, but in the summer it's minus five or something. There's people had a go at that, but I'm not confident that we've got to it. But I would say, you know, that if you follow the sort of the later calving that a lot of people have done on beef cow herds, you know, then you are sort of going into the winter and taking condition score off, so you're requiring less feed, and that's providing feed. You know, let's say you're weaning in April, you're shutting your cows down and dropping some condition off them. That's giving feed to sheep, which is what you're saying. We've done a rough calculation, or Bob Thompson has, that 100 cows that go from body condition score 7 to 5 in 100 days, so that's 3 months after weaning, they need about 25% less feed than 100 cows that might start at body condition score 5. You know, so you're taking that condition off, and that frees up enough feed to put on half a body condition score and 800 ewes. Does that make sense to you?
Yep.
So the less feed, as you take that condition off the cows, you're freeing up pasture that can put on half condition score and 800 ewes when you take that condition score for 100 cows.
Yep, and we've got some pretty good figures on the value of that extra body condition score of a ewe flock.
Yes, you have. Yes, you can do that. Or you can even put it on, if you're feeding hard, if you're feeding hay, you can say it requires, and this is quite a good one, it requires so many less bales of hay, and that's quite a dramatic one when you're talking to farmers as well.
So just on that, actually, it rang a wee bell in my head. I think it was worked out at some stage, you know, the quality of feed that a cow can grow a calf at 1 kilogram of dry matter on, bulls would be losing weight on at
correct.
A few hundred grams
correct.
A day.
Yeah. Yep. Everything would be, except maybe goats.
Yep.
but, you know, breeding ewes would be losing weight. Every other class of animal, the beef cow is the only one that will do it. Even if you stood big... big Angus steers or Friesian steers on that feed, they would just be maintaining.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go back. Right at the start, you said the first thing you'd say is the number one, getting that calf grown at that 1 kilogram of live weight gain per day. should be the target, should be what they're doing at the moment, and if they're not, look at why not. What is happening? Do you know what would be typical? And we talked about the calving percentage not being where it should be. What about calf live weight gain? Is it are people doing that, or what is the national sort of performance?
Yeah, well, that's another good question, Aaron, and one that you might that I ask groups of farmers whenever I meet them is that so what are your calves growing at? And a lot of people are guessing at that, or they might weigh them when they first come near the yards at calf marking. And often the first weight they get will be if they're selling them as weaners at the sale yards. But, you know, you just need to go around the sale yards and you sort of know calving dates in the region. And if anything's just around that 200 kilo mark, then they've only been growing at 0.7. That's the only way that we can get good data on these things. You know, all of our trial research that we do, you know, we've got weights and you know, everything's growing at around that kilo a day, but there's not a lot of people, even less, have got birth weights. I'm talking about our trials where we've got birth weights, so we do have the growth rate over the 200 days, but most farmers don't have calf birth weights. All they'll have is perhaps a weight of a sample at calf marking, which might be in November, and then they'll have another weight at weaning on a sample.
So what's the secrets to success then? Kilogram?
Sorry?
No, carry on. Are you going to explain what you're saying?
My guess is that probably nationally we're not doing much more than 800 grams a day.
Mm-hmm. So what's the drivers? I mean, to get that 1 kilogram a day, is it pasture quality? Is it the condition score of the cow when she calves? Or the genetics of the bull you use? What's the key?
All of those, but the immediate drivers, the one that farmers can take care of right now is that they should be on pasture where the cow can get a reasonable amount of food down its throat, you know, so that's, and that fits in with the pasture going slightly rank, you know, so it's up around 2,500 kilograms of dry matter per hectare on that hill country. You know, if they're only eating sheep pasture at around 12, 13, 14, 1500, the cow won't get enough intake, and so her condition won't be going up. She won't be getting enough to produce enough milk, and so the calf will suffer. They're the main things. But then you're right to draw on the genetics thing. Obviously, if it's a crossbred cow, if it's a dairy, it's a beef by dairy, say a Hereford Friesian or an Angus Friesian, then those cows will produce more milk at a cost, you know, at an extra feed cost. And if the calf's sired by a terminal sire, say a Charolais or something like that, then they'll grow slightly faster as well. So, you know, you just go to the sale yards in March and April and you see some of those early calves come through, which are exotic cross, you know, Charolais or Simtau. They might be growing at 1.2, maybe up as high as 1.3 kilograms a day. And if they're 40 kilograms at birth, then over 200 days, they've put on 260 kilograms plus their birth weight, and they're getting close to that sort of 290 kilograms at weaning. They're the ones that top all the sales.
So a couple of questions coming on genetics. One is around slightly related to the dairy industry. You know, the dairy industry talked about issues they had with cows getting too big and therefore issues giving back and calf and all those sorts of things. Is there a risk genetically that we run a risk of getting our beef cows too large for the hill country that they're on that we've talked about before? And when buying bulls, what should people be looking for to, you know, get a cow to a good ideal weight rather than getting too big and for the hill country?
Yeah, those of you who've heard me talk before, I certainly believe that we've pushed cow mature weight up too far. And those of you who are at fielding and May and heard Doreen Garrett talk, and that's what the Americans have done as well. So, and the main thing about that is the cost of production when you've got a bigger cow. Now, you've got more feed to get through the winter, and if we've pushed our beef cows back onto our harder, wetter hill country, then the big cow just doesn't make sense when it's only got one calf. You know, it may be a different story in sheep where you've got twins and triplets, but the cow size has to be moderate. You've got to be careful. You can't have too small a cow because, you know, we all want to get a calf out of it, a steer calf out of it, and we want to have it finished by 20 months or 18 months at 300 kilos. So it's got to be have some size there on the maternal side. But certainly we don't want these 600 kilo cows running around our hill country from an environmental point of view and from a feed point of view. So, you know, I would be choosing a bull breeder who puts a bit of effort on moderating cow mature weight and the breeding value for that, the EBV for that. I would be looking at someone that thinks like that. So the main thing is that if you're a commercial beef farmer, you'd be talking to your person that you're buying your bulls from that you know, and looking at their cows and saying, I don't want big cows. I want to choose a bull breeder that's got moderate sized cows. And then as I make my choice of bull within that thing, I might be putting, if you wanted to bring your size of cow down, you're putting a bit of a stop on mature weight, cow mature weight, EBV.
So can you maybe be a bit more specific about that when you say, you know, a moderate weight without, you know, narrowing it down to the nearest kilo, but what sort of range are you talking that in your work you would suggest is the ideal or the optimum or a good moderate weight?
Well, once you get out above 550, I'd say that's getting at the upper end. And
mm-hmm.
I always thought somewhere around that 500 was about it, pretty optimum. But again, you know, that's some of the research work we're doing now. We've got different cow sizes than that, and we haven't finished that work. But maybe 500 even is a bit big, but it's somewhere around that 475 to 525.
Mm-hmm. So, and if you're getting below that 475, you talked about the risk of getting too small as well. Was that?
I just threw that one in there because, you know, you've got to get a calf out of that animal. If it's a male calf, you want to get it. Everyone wants to get it finished by 20 months, don't they? You want to take it through two winters, so you've got to be careful about that.
But it's that's the thing, I think, you know, with cow sizes. And it's a bit, so you hear the same thing actually around hogget lambing, is it's the optimum size, but also the worry about getting a good sized calf out of the cow. What are the main drivers of calving difficulties in first calving? You know, usually an R2 cow, but what are the main issues that are likely to cause difficulty? Is it the bull and the size of the calf, or is it the size of the cow and how she's been grown out, or is there something else going on?
It's both of those. So the first one is that you want to choose the bull that you mate to that first calving heifer. Let's say it's, as you say, one that's calving first at 2 years of age, so it's going to the bull at 15 months. So that bull has to be an animal that's relatively below breed average or close to breed average for birth weight. Perhaps direct calving ease is certainly below or breed average. If you're keeping replacements, then calving ease maternal would have to be close to breed average. And so you'd be careful about your bull choice over those first calving heifers. And most bull breeders understand that, so you'd be talking to your bull breeder about that. That's the first thing. So you've got the right bull over those heifers. And then I'm a believer that those heifers have got to keep growing through at least, they need to be keep growing right through until, you know, the last month or so before calving. And so they've got to get to a size that they're able to calve relatively easy. So I'm not a fan of them being shut down over the winter to try and slow down calf growth in utero. That doesn't happen. You know, as we all know, the fetus is a parasite. It's going to keep growing even if you shut the heifer down and try and starve her to reduce birth weight. It's just not going to happen. The fetus is going to keep growing and utilizing body condition off the young heifer and therefore make her thinner and more prone to calving difficulty as you approach calving.
So if we're talking, you know, you're talking about what a good moderate size cow, that 475, 500 kilos, something around that, you know, broadly, without getting to, what would you like to see those heifer, what sort of weight should those heifers be when they go into the bull?
It's a calf. Minimum of 60% of the mature cow weight of your herd.
Uh-huh.
That assumes we all know what our mature cow weight is. So if it's 500, then they should be a minimum of 300 going to the bull.
And that's minimum. That's not the average of the heifer mob. That's
the
smallest heifer.
No, it's a minimum.
Yeah. Is there a case, this is another question that's come in, is there a case, or have you seen it, where a case for a calving is first as a three-year-old?
Well,
let's put you on the spot.
I guess there is way down in the Southern Alps, if you're up in the high country. I wouldn't say there is in the North Island. You really are questioning the role of the beef cow and its profitability if you're not going to get a calf out of it until it's three.
Uh-huh.
And the thing about that is that for someone who believes that it's too early to mate a cow at 15 months and better to mate it at 27, calf first at three, up their same road nearby, there'll be a farmer who is happily doing it at 15 months. So my belief is that it's really a management thing.
So another Corey question that actually ties in with that and is often chucked around. Straight breeds, crossbreeds, have you got any strong thoughts? Are there places where, you know, a crossbred cow genuinely can't work, or are they an opportunity that most beef cow farmers should be looking at?
Yeah, I changed my view on this over the years, and, you know, the soft answer to everyone out there now is you've got to have your market of where you're going to sell your animals worked out. So if you're going to sell them through a sale yards and you've got buyers who are going to buy weaner calves, then often those Charolais cross or terminal cross animals are going to be the top price of those sales, aren't they? So that would be one thing. But then if you're tied into a value chain like Hereford Prime or Angus Pure, then why would you change to crossbreeding if you know you're going to get a premium for that straightbred animal once it's killed, or the Wagyu, for example? So you really got to attack it from that point of view rather than just go back and just say, well, which is the best cow? Where are you going to sell the animals? And am I going to get a premium for breeding in this way or not?
So actually, tangentially related to that, one of the things that seems to be quite common or was popular more in the North Island, the South Island, is though, and you touched on it before, is the Hereford Friesian type cow, first cross out of the dairy industry and then mated to a terminal sire. And you've just sort of answered this question to some degree, saying it's, you know, target your market and those sorts of things. But leaving that aside, just on a technical basis, could those crossbreed cows have been used wider? I mean, they just never seem to really take off in the South Island.
Yeah, I'm not sure why they haven't taken off in the South Island. That they could be used wider. But again, they produce more milk, they produce a bigger calf, so they're going to take more feed. There's no doubt about that. You know, we've got some data on that. So they're going to take some more feed. And so, again, it comes back to the manager who's looking after those cattle. They've got to be fed accordingly. The thing about the Angus and our trial here at Massey that we'll be going looking at lifetime performance, the Angus cow is always, when we've got some Dairy Cross ones, a beef by Dairy Cross in there, the Angus cow is always 3/4 to 1 condition score better than the beef by Dairy Cross. And that's, and in this case, they're Angus Jerseys. That's simply they're handling the condition better, but they're also producing slightly less milk and slightly smaller calves at weaning, slower growth rate calves. So that, you know, that's the trade-off. But I mean, that better condition in hill country is your one way of getting through the winter, isn't it? It's going back to what I said before about taking that condition off that Angus cow is how you get through the winter and in the whole system frees up feed for other animals.
Is that difference in body condition score with those, you know, the Hereford Friesian type cow, not a factor of the fact, you know, the Friesians carrying more of their fat internally, or is it genuinely they just don't put it on like their productivity?
It's more productivity, I think, but there is a small bit. I mean, if you did a dissection of the carcass, then that would definitely hold what you just said there, Aaron. But it's more that they've produced more milk and faster, bigger calves.
Yep. Okay. All right. Look, just actually tying right in with this whole sort of thing around calving and productivity of the cow, a question that's just come in. Does feeding in early pregnancy, either minimising it or maximising it, have an effect on the birth weight of the calf?
Yeah. Interesting. So we had a PhD on that because we'd heard that way back. People kept saying, you know, and where this comes from is in a growthy December, January, February, some practitioners out there sort of indicated that that led to more calving difficulty the following spring. So that was that early pregnancy, the first third of pregnancy that there was too fast a fetal growth. We've tried to recreate that in an experiment here and been unable to recreate it, you know, by really feeding them well or actually starving them. Actually, it's quite hard to starve a cow in December, January. you know, you have to get the cover right down low and quite hard to set up those situations, but we did, and we've not been able to recreate that, so I'm not sure that happens, actually, because it was all about, thought was about placental size, or maybe setting the animal up to be able to, the nutrient exchange points in the placenta to exchange nutrients in later in pregnancy, but we've never been able to recreate it, and I'm not sure that it's a real phenomenon here in New Zealand and the way we run our cows.
All right.
So I would say it doesn't matter what you do.
Yep. I think that will have definitely answered the caller's question or the emailed question. A few sort of bits and pieces now sort of around, and they're all basically related to cow production, interestingly. BBD. As a kind of productivity. Now, this seems, the question here was that this seems to come and go in the press and the PR, you know, the level of it, but how big a problem is it? What's the best way for commercial cow farmers to deal with it? And the second part of the question was, can we actually eradicate it from our beef herd?
Yeah, I'm not. The first thing for that person that has asked that question is they should consult their local veterinarian and get a program. I'm not a veterinarian, and I'm not sure that we can eradicate it now. It's too widespread. I don't think we can. It's been talked about, but I'm not the right person to ask that question to.
Okay. Do you think, just generally speaking, though, Steve, do you think, you know, it could be a significant factor in why the national calving percentage, and certainly in some herds, is just not getting where they hoped it would, or we hope it could?
In some herds, it might be an issue, in individual herds. I don't think there are some people out there who, Paul Hughes and Ty Happy, has looked at this. In isolated herds, it might be, but I don't think nationally it's probably contributing that much.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yard weaning. So there's another one that was for a while quite popular. There was certainly a lot of press about it, and not quite the flavour of the month, but there was certainly a lot of talk about it. Have you had much involvement with that, and is it really an opportunity for farmers that can, you know, have the facilities or the opportunity to do it? Is it worth pursuing?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? The Australians were the big ones who pushed this, and I can understand them pushing it because they've got some pretty crazy cattle over there out on some of those big stations, especially with the stuff with a bit of Bos indicus in it, and they've only seen people when it comes to weaning, so they do need to be quietened down. So that's where it came from. I know a group up in Gisborne were very keen on this and got some good results. We ran a trial here this autumn with it, and we're going to do it again. I'd say the jury's still out. It is quite a lot more work, although it's a time of the year, perhaps, where in the autumn where there's not too much going on. You've got to have some feed for those calves if you're going to keep them in the yard. And quite a lot of our hill country farmers don't have anything that they can feed them in the yard. You know, they don't have any good silage or anything like that. So it's something that has to be planned pretty well. Maybe on biggish properties it'll have an advantage, but I'm not sure. It really depends on how your cattle have been handled through up until the point in time of weaning. If they've seen plenty of people and they've been handled quite a lot up until then, I'm not sure the advantages are that big.
Okay, actually moving on, final question that's not directly about beef cows, but, you know, growing the calves out post-weaning, and you may actually be able to comment on in some detail on this one. With you, I know you've done quite a bit of work on some of these herb and clover mixes and these sorts of things. Two-part question again, are some of these specialist crops useful for cattle, especially given with the high clover content and the risk of bloat? And the second part of it is there a risk of meat quality issues with some of these forage crops? I think you're talking about dark cutters or flavour issues or things like that, moving away from just standard grass and clover?
Yeah, dealing with the last one first, we haven't done any meat quality on cattle grazing. I guess you're talking about herb-clover mixes or clover-herb mixes, so you're talking about plantain, chicory, red and white clover. We've done sheep flavour work, so we don't get too many different flavours and from lambs and that, you know, we've done taste panels on that. We haven't done any cattle ones. I suspect it won't be too much. You're right to be, people are right to be worried about bloat because, you know, the big advantage of these clover herb pastures is that they've got about 25% clover. So you maybe got to think about bloat capsules if you're growing them. But they certainly grow faster. We've had bulls on, we've had little 100 kilo bulls in about this time of the year, and we've turned them into 300 kilo bulls by 1st of May. And the maximum growth live weight gain we've had on herb clover mixtures is 1.3 through January and February kilograms per head per day. So they grow on these things.
Yep.
And actually, I think someone who's got a plantain, we like chicory as well, but some people don't because of the difficulty in controlling the weeds in chicory, red and white clover, that when you know, you've done something with your sheep on them up until about now, and then you put your cattle, we were using Frisian bulls, so we're picking up animals from the dairy industry. But, I mean, you could perhaps be weaning early or something like that in late January and putting those calves on that Herbtober mm-hmm. mix, and they'll grow well through there. The problem, of course, is that you've got to get them off to give the long taproot of the chicory and plantain time to recover over the winter. So you've got to take them off in sort of late May, June, and leave them not grazed through July until the spring, until they start growing again.
Did you you mentioned bloat and bloat capsules with do you have any bloat concerns or risks, and can you actually capture all calves, you know, that 100 kilo through to 300 kilo live weight?
No, well, we didn't. But you still want to be watching that.
Mm.
I think it's probably the consistent grazing, you know, not the feast or famine, which sort of leads mm-hmm. to bloat, you know, the rotation or how you're going. So these animals were on this feed all the time.
Hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting one. Even with sort of related, even with sheep on lucerne down here, the advice is always never shift them hungry, because that's when you run into sort of issues if they've got an empty gut and then go in and gorge themselves. So I suspect it may be the same thing. Sorry, yep, look, next question, and finally one that's not to do with beef cows, but it is around bull beef, and you just talked about a bull. So bull beef systems on, you know, high-quality feed show very high or, you know, very competitive gross margins because of their feed conversion efficiency, but there's some high risks. I think we're not talking so much about productivity risks, but risks to farmers and farm managers and all those indirect costs that come from farming bulls. The money's attractive, but how can we minimise and mitigate, avoid, remedy those, you know, behavioural issues and risks? Is there some way, what are the tricks to farming bulls safely and quietly, I guess? And the specific rider on that was the vaccines and things that are around. Are they any use?
We've played with them in the past. I don't think they really are adding much. I think the people who are very, very good at farming bulls and have done so for 15 or 20 years do it quietly. They're very careful how they move bulls. They've got very good infrastructure, electric fences, very good yard, very, very good yards and lead up to yards. They're very careful how they move bulls. You know, they've got their systems of how mob size. You know, they don't. There's not one size fits all. You know, you can't say no bigger mob than 20. Others do different things. They don't mix, and some don't mix and mix mobs together. They keep them together all the way through. So there's a lot of tricks. But I agree with whoever's asked the question. Simply doing a gross margin with bulls, and they do come out well, but you've got to factor in some damage they might have done to pastures with holes around troughs. You know, you've got to factor in the infrastructure that you might have to change in terms of electric fences and outriggers. So all of that should be taken care of.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Look, just looking at the time, we're sort of coming to the end of our time, and so I've got one last question, and it's not really a bull question or a cow question. It's more about a systems type question. Is there, you know, we've talked about reasonably intensive systems and extensive systems. Is there a place, given cows' ability to convert feed, and we see them, you know, in feedlots and these sorts of things, is there a place for that sort of containment feeding? If not a shed, then just, you know, contain and feed bought to them in New Zealand sheep and beef systems? Is there any way or any situation where that might be a more profitable operation than harvesting feed in situ in the paddock? And I guess the question here may be thinking about some of the wetter or colder areas in winter and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, do you look across at the dairy industry and see where they went on that? It really does come back to the price and the market, doesn't it? It's funny how my phone rings when beef price gets over $5 and heading up towards $6. I get a lot of calls about people wanting to investigate feedlots. If the beef price drops down to $4, I get no calls about it. So it's really, if you're going to move that way, so you're adding cost, perhaps more risk, more labour, more machinery, if you're into a confinement system, and therefore you've got to be pretty guaranteed about the market of your animal. That would be my only comment on that one.
Brilliant. No, it's, I suspect we get the same thing as you when times are good. All these sort of systems don't look so bad. Yeah. All right. We have come to the end of our time tonight, ladies and gentlemen, so I'm going to call it to a close there. Thank you for sending in the questions, both before the call and the ones that have come in during the call. We'll have the recording up, as I said, very soon on our podcast channel, and once it's up there, we'll flick an email out to all of you that have registered with a link to that and a link to some bits and pieces that were referenced or referred to tonight or that Steve mate thinks may be worth reading. So thank you all for dialing in and listening to the call. We appreciate your time and your questions. And finally, a big thank you to our guest tonight, who's, as you may have heard at the start, is just not long returned from overseas and straight back into the from the frying pan into the fire, so to speak, on the call tonight. So look, thanks very much to Professor Steve Morris of University for coming on tonight, of Massey University, pardon me. Thank you all, and good night.